This Monday, there'll be a total solar eclipse, as we've talked about. Our family plans on traveling south to Ohio to see it. Maybe others do as well. I have, though, often wondered how people experienced eclipses before they could be reliably predicted. Or even more dramatically, what it was like to be amongst the first human beings who ever experienced a solar eclipse at all. We know that the first historical record of an eclipse comes from cave paintings from 3340 BCE, discovered in present-day Ireland. The first written records are from China, dating from sometime in 1200 BCE, and they evocatively state that the sun was consumed. We know that many cultures came to produce very, very dramatic myths about eclipses. The sun was eaten by a dragon, or a demon, or a snake, or chased around the sky and went into hiding because it was attacked by a pack of wolves. Or that an eclipse was a sign of God's wrath. Alongside these mythic explanations, though, many ancient cultures got pretty good at predicting eclipses, although they still tended to see them as predictive or as signs, and usually inauspicious ones or bad ones. It wasn't until after Copernicus that eclipses could be predicted with total precision. And so Columbus, great guy, famously used his more exact knowledge of the timing of an eclipse to extort supplies and food from the people he met in Jamaica. I think it is safe to say that experiencing an eclipse is a very different event if you don't know that it's going to happen beforehand. And I, as I said in the beginning, can't even begin to imagine the experience of that first unprecedented eclipse. I feel like this is good context for approaching the story of Thomas in the Gospel of John. The story begins on Easter evening. The disciples are hiding away in fear behind locked doors when Jesus suddenly enters the room and says, "Peace to you." And he shows the disciples the marks of the crucifixion. But one of the 12, Thomas, is missing. Later, the other disciples try to convince Thomas that Jesus had been there, that he had been raised from the dead. But Thomas asserts, "I'll never believe it. I'll never believe it unless I can put my fingers in the nail holes and my whole hand in the spear hole." Because of this demand for proof, Thomas is often referred to as Doubting Thomas, a nickname that only makes a sense, I think, from the vantage point far, far, far on the other side of Easter. Personally, I am not sure that I ever heard the story of Jesus' death without knowing that he was resurrected. Like many kids, I learned about Easter long before I learned about Good Friday. I have only ever heard the grisly story of that day, already knowing that everything was going to be all right in the end. I never experienced it as a terrible surprise. I think I've said this before, but I think that is why I found it so meaningful and made such a huge impression on me as a child when I first read the biography of Martin Luther King in fourth grade. I honestly did not know how that story would end when I began reading it. I was caught off guard by the terrible turn the story took. And because Thomas doesn't come to Good Friday from the vantage point of Easter, he experienced Jesus' death as a shocking conclusion to a story that he thought would go another way. The post-resurrection accounts of Jesus run the gamut. There is the dramatic appearance to Mary and the disciples in the upper room. And the more gentle appearance that we talked about last Sunday to the Emmaus disciples on the road. The story of Thomas is different. It ends with the concluding theological point, "Blessed are the people who believe in Jesus without seeing him." And it's interesting, I think, to note that even in the world of the gospel writers, Jesus does not appear to every downcast and confused traveler on the road, to every pilgrim discussing the strange things that have just happened in Jerusalem. Last week, I talked about how I can take comfort in the hiddenness of Jesus, the recognition that we can never quite tell when it is Jesus who is walking beside us. But in this story, Jesus' hiddenness is experienced as painful to Thomas. Thomas has experienced something unbelievably traumatizing. And this sudden, surprising, unanticipated eclipse, within this, he has no assurance that the sun will return. At this point, he needs much more than rumors or even his friends' strenuous arguments that Jesus has risen. Thomas needs to experience glory, apparent not just in words. He needs to see that real resurrection is possible in a world that crucifies and devastates. Thomas needed to see the resurrection incarnate within the woundedness of creation. He needed to see glory written in wounds and scars. This was the only way that he could believe. The only way that he could believe that resurrection had visceral implications for his own life. And far from being a doubter, I think Thomas demonstrated a great deal of boldness. I tend to think that it is faith that makes us bold enough to ask God for signs, to keep opening up thin places in the world where we might see God. No one questions the faith of Moses because he asked to see the face of God. So why question the faith of Thomas when he asks to see Jesus' wounds? And I tend to think that God finds us where we at. People that are looking for external signs often experience them, I think. Those of us who prefer to be more gently persuaded very often are. Anyways, that's just some thoughts on Thomas. Today, I want to end by thinking a bit about uncertainty. Our new worship series is entitled Being Led During Times of Uncertainty. And I think as we begin this series, it is important to note that there are different types of uncertainty, with perhaps different levels of attendant anxiety. For instance, there is the profound uncertainty of our imagined ancient person experiencing a totally unforeseen and unprecedented eclipse. I have compared this level of uncertainty to the devastation that Thomas experienced at the death of Christ. Second, there is the sense of foreboding of an ancient person who knows that eclipses sometimes happen and can't necessarily predict them and doesn't fully understand them. There is the surprise of the pre-modern person who can't perfectly predict eclipses but can get pretty close and has a general theory about why they happen and knows that they don't last forever. And finally, there are people in our position who might feel a bit eerie as the moon passes over the sun, but who are working with a solid estimate of when the sun will return in full force. Right now, as I look at our world, there are a lot of things to feel uncertain about. When we consider climate change, there is a sense of something unprecedented and foreboding. We are facing profound uncertainty. We are experiencing a new challenge to human beings that hasn't happened before and that we're experiencing in real time. We can't look back at history for a record of something that's entirely like this. As we look towards the next election, we know that present events might not be totally historically unprecedented, but they are certainly unpredictable and scary and feel beyond our capacity to control. It is natural to feel deep unease and powerlessness in face of uncertainty. And I think it's important to speak about this anxiety as a substratum in which we live. Perhaps one that affects how we experience our normal anxieties. And this might be things we focus on in this series. I want to be careful with what I say next, because I don't want to practice kind of unhealthy spiritual bypassing or the tendency to downplay the reality of our own experiences of sadness because things could always be worse or because we know that God will make everything good in the end. But I'm going to risk it. I think as we look forward towards making a decision about our building, I do recognize that there is some uncertainty, but I think we are solidly in the category of the person who, although they can't perfectly predict when the eclipse happens, knows that they can, that they do periodically come and can rest in the assurance that the sun will return with full force. So there is uncertainty, but I think uncertainty that we can all weather with good cheer. We've done this before. Shalom has met in people's homes, at Rudolf Steiner School, at Lawton Elementary, at Abbott School, at Northside Church, at Ann Arbor Seventh-day Adventist, at Gretchen's house, on Zoom, and here at Greenwood. With each move, there have been joys and new frustrations, new people and new inspirations. And this decision about where we move will be an important one. It will undeniably shape us on the next leg of our journey. But I think we can make this decision with an open heart. Let us not get too distracted. Church is a special place in large part because it is a gathering where we help each other navigate those totally unprecedented and world-upending eclipses that come our way now and again. Whether collective ones like COVID or climate change or political instability, or individual ones like death or disease or loss of jobs. What we possess together is much greater than any building can hold. And I'm not the first to say this, right? Your old pastor, Paul Versluis, used to refer to Shalom as a school of love. And one of the first Sundays I was here in person, Trevor called Shalom a love shack. Now, we've not been existing in a shack as of late, but we could. Most of us have not been given any dramatic appearance of Jesus, at least not in an embodied presence. But at his best, church is a place where we represent and represent Jesus to each other. A God, a place where God's presence does, I think, become apparent in wounds and scars. A place of grace in a world that can crucify and devastate. A place where we can learn to speak as a people who know that the powers are formidable and perhaps even at times insurmountable, but they are not ultimate. A place where we can look together for the return of the sun.